This is The Guardian.
Some people say you're boring and stiff. Tell me something. Yes. You must surely see why so many voters think it's time for you and the Conservatives to get your P45.
Well, the first thing I'd say is the Tories are in no position to lecture anyone about tax rises.
Promise number three, reducing national debt. It's gone up since you made the pledge, hasn't it? It has.
Yeah. But it was always meant to come down over time.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. So we are back here in my sitting room in East Dulwich.
And I feel like this is home now.
He's making himself at home. He's got himself a beer and everything. And we've just finished watching the latest leaders event. I can't call it a debate because, of course, it wasn't quite a debate. It was Beth Rigby of Sky News interviewing each of the leaders of the Conservative and Labour Party, Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak, and then them being faced by audience questions separately. And I actually have to say, there's a lot of talk about who wins these events, who wins these debates. And I actually think that the winner here was Beth Rigby. I thought that her questioning was very rigorous and she kind of put pressure on them at points where, that were really effective. She kind of knew their weak spots. And she also kind of got the audience on side. I think one of the biggest rounds of applause from the evening was when she challenged Rishi Sunak about broken promises, talking about Brexit inside of the bus and levelling up. And she got this round of applause when she said, isn't it time for the government to have their P45?
Your problem is broken promises, and it's deeper than the last couple of years. It's Brexit too. It's migration. It's migration. The NHS was meant to get better. We were all remember 350 million quid on the side of a bus, don't we? It's levelling up. It's a catalogue of broken promises. You must surely see why so many voters think it's time for you and the Conservatives to get your P45.
Well, I can absolutely.
But she also helped interpret some of Keir Starmer's language as well. There was a moment where he was talking about tax rises and talking about not having any plans for them. And she kind of decoded that for the audience and explained what that actually meant. He's not ruling it out. It could yet happen at some point.
Nothing in our manifesto requires tax rises over and above those that we have specifically set out.
No tax rises in the next Parliament?
No tax rises needed in the plans in our manifesto.
In the plans?
No tax rises for working people. That's income tax, national insurance,
VAT. So you're not ruling out. I just decode that for you guys. Because when a politician says no plans, it does mean I might.
Well, Beth, I'm not.
I've done this a bit. It does.
And I thought that was really, it was just very aware of her audience and the, recognising that our world that, you and I inhabit, Kieran, can sometimes be a bit impenetrable to some people. And actually, to make politics accessible, you do need to be able to talk about things in sort of inhuman language.
That was a really interesting moment where she turned to the audience. And she'd been doing this back and forth with Keir Starmer about whether he was going to raise taxes, which is the same back and forth that you've been doing with him, that I've been doing with him, that all of us on the campaign trail have been kind of partaking in for the last few days. And she kind of got the same answers from him. And then she turned to the audience and she said, when a politician says I have no plans to do something, it means I might. And I thought that was kind of fascinating tactic because usually broadcasters tend to be a bit more buttoned up about these things. Let the audience interpret that is the kind of mantra for a lot of us. If we think that somebody is dissembling in front of us, we simply let them do it and then let the audience see that for what it is. Or you get super aggressive with your questioning. She didn't either. Mm. She was quite disarming. She turned to the audience and she kind of let them in on it. And I thought that was a really important moment. And also it forced Keir Starmer to try to put him on the back foot and it got him out of his natural rhythm.
Yeah.
And it forced him to kind of listen to how he was being heard. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was one of my big takeaways from tonight, is Keir Starmer realising live in front of an audience how he comes across.
Yeah. And very different to sort of the head-to-head debates, where at the last one, they were given 45 seconds each to respond. There was lots of interrupting. It felt very much that they were just trying to deliver their sound by, you know, yeah, their clip for the cameras. This wasn't like that. This was a sort of a much broader piece. And I thought that it was more effective as a result of that. I also like getting, we had Rowena, our colleague in the Rowena Mason in the spin room. And I've enjoyed getting updates from the, this is the room next to the event where the politicians afterwards try and sort of persuade that their guy has won. Somebody sent us through a picture of an ice bucket. Obviously, they like to keep the journalists well lubricated. It's not just here in my sitting room that we're doing that. And there's an ice bucket with various beers. And Sky have got a beer which has got a label of the silhouette of a woman with sort of a black bob and red lipstick. And it is, of course, Beth Rigby, but it's called Beth Rigbeer. I thought that was funny. Maybe
Sky
not.
Sky are quite good at those branded little freebies.
It made me chuckle events. Anyway. But the audience post-debate, there was a snap poll by YouGov of the of viewers at home. They suggested that Keir Starmer had won actually quite overwhelmingly, 64% to 36%. And I don't think, well, I certainly didn't think it was that clear cut. You might view it differently. I kind of thought that Rishi Sunak was, yes, he looked pretty despondent. And actually, I think it's hard for him to kind of get out of this sort of sense that they're giving up. They've had such a turbulent campaign. But I thought it was really striking that he's a better communicator. He's better at talking to people in sort of like everyday language, and looked much more relaxed and didn't feel as though he was so bogged down in the detail. With Keir Starmer, it felt like he had a list of points. I know this from interviewing myself, that he has sort of a list of points in his head that he knows that he wants to deliver. And maybe it's the lawyer in him getting down into the detail, but he'll be thinking to himself, okay, these are 3 points I need to say, and he'll just keep going. He just kept talking. And sometimes I think that he didn't then appear as instinctive or as relaxed as that you might really expect to see him. And certainly the contrast with Rishi Sunak and that I thought was quite stark.
No, I agree with you. I was shocked by that YouGov poll. I thought Rishi Sunak had handled it very well. And I've seen Rishi Sunak do PM Connect events, which is where he stands up in front of an audience and just takes questions on anything, a kind of soapbox moment. And he's actually very good at it. And one of the reasons he's good, I think, is not only that he's on top of the detail, but he's able to translate the detail into human. He does speak human. And what he's able to do is weave policies into a bit of a narrative. So he doesn't just talk about NHS targets. He talks about what that might mean for hospitals and for nurses and for patients. He's good at remembering people's names, and he brings his examples and his points back to whatever they've said to him. So he incorporates their question and their experience into his answers. Now, we've said before that occasionally he gets a bit tin-eared because he's desperate to explain all the time instead of emoting and understanding and listening to what people say. I thought he was pretty good tonight at listening to what people were saying. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting because Sky then interviewed some of the audience members about what they'd thought about it afterwards. And a couple of people who said they'd voted Tory pretty solidly in the past both said almost identical things about Sunak, which was that he looked despondent. Mm-hmm. And I thought he looked calm and thoughtful, potentially humble. And he's obviously had a very, very tough campaign. I thought that would come across well. But actually, I think what that was coming across for a lot of people as was, this guy looks like he's lost.
And yet there were a couple of bits which were actually quite lighthearted, really, weren't there? I mean, there was a question, I thought a really good question from Beth to both of them at the end, to sort of tell the audience something about themselves that might make people like them better. And Rishi Sunak's answer was, well, you know, you all think I've got a healthy lifestyle, but actually I eat loads of Haribo and Twix, contrary to popular belief.
People seem to think I have a very kind of healthy lifestyle and I go to the gym and all this obsession about my fasting, but I actually have an appalling diet because I eat an enormous amount of sugar and I'm very unhealthy in that regard, which I was talking to someone today about. They were completely shocked. I'm not sure that's not really something that someone needs to like me more or less, but that's something I was talking to someone today and they're genuinely surprised about the amount of Haribos, Twixes and everything else that I get through, particularly during a campaign.
And I actually thought that was really funny. They're probably not the reasons that Rishi Sunak might have wanted people to laugh at it, in that he obviously was just trying to share something that made him sound a lot more like down to earth, human. You know, we all stuff our faces full of chocolate. I've got a box of Maltesers sitting on the front on the table in front of me. Now empty box of Maltesers, else I'd shake it and you could hear. But actually it just came a bit like across like, what a random thing to say.
No.
You know, and are people really going to vote for you when they weren't previously because you eat lots of Twix and Haribos?
But you know what? How on earth do you answer that question?
How would you answer? I don't know.
Tell you something about myself that would make you like me more. I mean, I have no idea what I would say. The only thing I could think of is you could talk about your family, couldn't you? In that, you know, I make sure that every weekend I spend a lot of time with my kids, and that takes a lot of energy.
And tell a funny story about them.
Them, and you know,
everyone always likes hearing about how families take the piss out of
politicians.
You know, oh well, my family always say I do this. Oh, and they always accuse me of that, and I'm the one that's, you know.
But you know what? Had the question been, tell us something unexpected about you, that's okay, because then you can do self-deprecation. But because it was, tell us something that would make people like you more, you couldn't just
sound like you're showing off.
I think it was a really tough, and neither of them, I think, answered it very well. But I thought actually Rishi Sunak's answer was a bit better, because he at least kind of dealt with it in the light-hearted manner in which it was meant. And Keir Starmer throughout tonight just really struggled, I thought, to get off his planned messages and to deal with people as human beings. And that just came across time and again.
And then, of course, when Keir Starmer answered that question, it sounded just like he was rolling off his CV. It wasn't anything that particularly would make people more likely to vote for him. It's just, I guess, from his point of view, to try and underline that he was in it because he wanted to serve. And he kept saying that, I'm here in the service of the people. Just felt slightly contrived.
Some people feel that they don't really know you. Some people say you change your mind all the time. And I hinted at some of that. Some people say you're boring and stiff. Tell me something. Tell me something, a morsel about yourself that will change people's minds.
Well, look, all my life I've believed in service. That is why I worked in Northern Ireland with the Police Service of Northern Ireland to ensure it had the confidence of both communities. I thought that was a really important thing. That's why I worked and headed up the Crown Prosecution Service, public service. That's why I came into politics when I finished as Director of Public Prosecutions and wondered what to do next. My wife was ringing adverts.
He obviously has a pretty impressive CV, you know, but it just didn't feel the right pitch, the right tone in response to a question like that. It was really serious. But then it was sort of underlined by somebody in the audience suggesting that actually Keir Starmer is a bit robotic.
I admired how in touch you were with the public when you were obviously a solicitor and then you became a director of public prosecutions with CPS. But over the last year, I feel like you've formed into more of a politician than the person that I would have voted for to run the country. You seem more like a political robot. How are you going to convince others like me to vote for you?
Well, the most...
it's tricky, isn't it? Because somebody's pointing out essentially a character flaw,
or
presentational flaw. How do you kind of turn that around on its head, particularly when you're being accused of being robotic and your response actually sounds quite robotic?
It was terribly robotic. I mean, it was a young man called Cayman. And actually, I thought it was a really good question and a moment where Starmer could have just taken a beat, thought about the question and said, you know what? I have changed. It's really difficult doing politics and you're under this much scrutiny and you have to stay on the script and you have to get your messages home. And I'm sorry if I sound boring, but I think it's so important.
Made a virtue of it.
Make a virtue of it. Yeah, sorry. This is what it's like and this is the job I'm having to do.
And somebody who maybe had a defter touch in moments like this might have been able to do that.
And one thing that really has struck me about Keir Starmer, and it goes back to the stories about his biography, And you will remember that Tom Baldwin, who wrote Keir Starmer's biography, originally was planning to write it as a ghost-written autobiography, then went to Keir Starmer, and Starmer looked at it and said, look, I really like it, but it just doesn't feel like me. And I think one of the things that I've noticed time and time again about him is he's absolutely terrible at introspection. He cannot talk about himself in any natural way. And it makes him very uptight, I think. And one of the things that came through in that book was that has been a character trait of his. And it's a defense mechanism. It's a defense mechanism, as Tom Baldwin describes it, against a very, very difficult upbringing. And what Starmer did during that upbringing was slightly retreat into himself and kind of throw himself into his career and his, you know, serious attention to detail and, you know, all the things that he's done as a forensic lawyer. Being a politician requires just a different set of skills, and you have to just be a bit more self-aware.
Yeah. I interviewed Keir Starmer last weekend, and the first thing I said, we went into this sort of like storage room effectively in a community centre out in Essex. And it was full of like sort of a jumble of stuff. And I sort of went in and commented on the room, and he said, "Oh, you know, how are you?" And I said, "Oh, you know, I'm all right, except that the start of the campaign meant I had to cut short my holiday with my kids," and, you know, talked about a little bit about that, and then sat down and got on with the interview. And later on that day, I was reading a piece about Keir Starmer, and it suggested some of the stuff that you were talking about. And it basically suggested that he doesn't really have much patience for when people talk about themselves, because it's not natural to him. And I just thought, oh God, I did absolutely the wrong thing there. I went into the room and started talking about my holiday. Maybe I should have gone in with a really serious point about some like polling analysis or sort of, you know, some hot take on the election. But anyway, the interview seemed to go all right. So obviously he wasn't that put out by it. But back to the debate for a minute. I actually thought that Starmer got off to a pretty good start because he was asked a really quite challenging question initially by Beth Rigby, which was, why should the public trust you when you've changed your mind so many times? And she gave examples of, for example, his leadership manifesto pledges and other pledges he had made or policy positions he'd had that he subsequently shifted position on. And we all know that sort of that really quite damaging flip-flop accusation that Boris Johnson levied at him, which seemed to stick.
How can the people in this room trust anything you say?
When we lost the 2019 election, we lost very badly as a political party, including here in Grimsby, where people felt that they couldn't vote for the Labour Party. And I concluded that I should listen to the electorate. And when you lose that badly, you don't look to the voters and say, "What on earth do you think you were doing?" You look at your party and say, "We have to change."
And the change
that I wanted to bring about, and I have brought about, is to change the Labour Party, to put it back in the service of working people. And what has guided me through that at all times is that the country must come first and the party second.
I actually thought his answer on it was really good. He basically said that what's important here is what people in the country think, not what we in the Labour Party think. And I think if you're listening from home as somebody that didn't vote for Labour in 2019, then you might actually think, you know what, actually, that's quite self-aware. And that is also the right course of action, to sort of think about the country rather than the political party. The other thing is taxes, which have come up an awful lot during this election campaign, unsurprisingly perhaps. And Labour has said that they wouldn't put up VAT, national insurance or income tax, as have the Conservatives. But Starmer was interesting. I thought it was interesting that Starmer didn't rule out a series of tax rises. He said that there wasn't going to be any surprises in their manifesto and that there wouldn't be any extra taxes on working people. But then he gave the same answer that he gave to me in that interview last week. He said, "I'm not going to sit here tonight and write the next 5 years of budgets, and you wouldn't take me seriously if I did." Mm. And so while he's saying there's not going to be tax rises to deliver anything that they're promising in the manifesto, he's not making that promise, you know, longer term. And I suppose what they'll do is they'll come in, as we've discussed before, and sort of, you know, see that the state of the economy is much worse than they thought it was. And they'll basically have to deliver a tough message to the public that, you know, probably blaming it on the Tories. But if they come in and they win, they will then have to do some really, really tough things because of the state of the economy. And that might include tax rises at some point.
Yeah, well, I thought Beth had the perfect riposte to that, which is, you already are writing 5 years of budgets because you're promising not to raise VAT, national insurance or income tax. I mean, those are the three biggest revenue raises. So you're already writing your future budgets. What's different about capital gains tax or council tax? And it's obvious what's different. He doesn't want to rule them out because he might want to raise them at some point. And I thought she was very good, as we said earlier, about pointing that out. I thought there was also a moment where she asked him about fuel duty, and his answer on fuel duty was, "I will decide that budget by budget." I think the Tories will be delighted at that response, even though their response would probably be relatively similar. The point about fuel duty is Fuel duty is supposed to go up every year, and each budget, the government says, I'm going to freeze it as a special.
They've gone up for 11 years or something
in a row. Yeah, and the reason they don't do it permanently is because if they say it's just a temporary measure, they can bank it in the future, which makes the future economic revenue forecast look better and means they can hit their long-term debt forecast. So it's all financial fiddling. But it was interesting that he said that. The one point where Starmer was really good on policy was in defending his decision to levy VAT on private school fees. I say really good, not as a judgment on the policy, but more because this was something I think he could lean into. Mm-hmm. He wasn't being evasive. He wasn't trying to dodge the question. And the question was from a father in the audience who said, this is going to hurt my family. I send my daughters to private school. I'm not a rich person. I'm just a normal person. And this will make life tougher for us. And Starmer took that on the chin, but he also defended it in the face of that level of criticism.
Look, let me be really clear about what we're doing here. I have nothing against private schools. I absolutely recognise that many parents work hard and save hard to send their children to private schools because they have aspiration for their children. I equally accept that every parent has aspiration for their children, whether they go to private school or not.
And it was that moment where he's just decided to stick by his guns on something, and you can win people over when you do that. And I thought that was a moment of genuine passion from him that really resonated with the audience.
Mm. Now, moving back to Rishi Sunak, I mean, he had quite a torrid time, actually, didn't he? There's quite a few moments where he was getting sort of, you know, heckled from the audience and even a boo at one point. And not all the questions were about policy. Some of them were also quite personal. And unsurprisingly, perhaps, one of Beth Rigby's early questions was about D-Day and the fact that he came back from the commemorations early for a television interview. And she asked him a question, he gave his stock response, and then she followed it up with, how do you feel?
Mm. And when you realised the mistake and you apologised, how were you feeling? Did you feel really awful? How was it for you?
Yeah, I was incredibly sad to have caused people hurt and upset. That was actually the last thing that I wanted to do. And as I said, I hope people can find it in their hearts to forgive me. When I realised I made a mistake, I apologised. I've asked for forgiveness.
I thought that was a really good opportunity for him to show some contrition and to show that he'd reflected on it. And maybe it's just I'm too much of a cynic, but then he came out with this line we've heard repeatedly over the weekend, which is that he hopes for the forgiveness of the public over this. And it just felt like, oh, this is the go-to line. And I just thought that could be in a moment where maybe he was trying to sound contrite. Maybe he genuinely is contrite. I mean, I actually thought he might be about to cry at one point.
Yeah, he did seem to have tears in his eyes.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure whether that was the lighting or what.
Yeah. And then the next thing that Beth did was ask about, given all the chaos and confusion we've seen in the last few years, you know, we've had however many prime ministers and chancellors and health secretaries, how can anyone expect you to be leader if you're re-elected within, you know, this time next year? And his response again, I thought, was an opportunity missed, because he said, well, I know we haven't got everything right, and then started talking about the progress they'd actually made, rather than, I think, maybe being more open with people and acknowledging that people feel not just frustrated, as he's put it, but really angry about some of the turmoil that this country has gone through.
Yeah, and you got that very much through the questioning, didn't you? There was a real sense of anger in the audience. And, you know, there were a couple of moments where I think you had people that you would have thought might vote Conservative said that they'd voted Conservative in the past.
Well, there was a Conservative chairman, wasn't there? A chairwoman.
Yeah, Amy, who said she used to be a Conservative chair. She'd been a lifelong Conservative activist, was now an undecided voter. And she brought up Partygate, and she brought up a couple of things, but she brought up particularly the picture of the Queen being left on her own at Prince Philip's funeral while there was a party going on in Number 10 at the same time.
I just think that, and I'll be very honest here, that picture of the Queen, our late Queen, who was left to bury her husband on her own during COVID, following guidance that we all followed and knowing what was happening in Downing Street, and you were part of that and you had a fixed penalty notice and you've apologised and I understand all of that, that's where the trust broke down. And I just think we have long memories in this country as a public, and you really will have to go some. And I appreciate the apology tonight. Thank you very much. but that you have to realise that there is a long way to go to really rebuild that.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And actually, I thought this was one of Sunak's weakest answers. I don't know how you felt, but he's instantly started saying those rules were difficult to follow, as if that was some kind of excuse.
Those rules were difficult for everyone to follow, and the government should absolutely have gone above and beyond in following them. And I deeply regret what happened. I apologise for it.
Yeah, it was the same as a few weeks ago. He did a Q&A in a, I think it was a factory, and one of the workers challenged him on the fact that he'd got a fine during Partygate. And then there was an opportunity for Sunak to answer. And again, it's a bit of a theme building, isn't it? He could have said something which was more relatable, which kind of showed that he understood why people were angry and sort of that he understood, you know, be more empathetic about what they'd been through. And instead, his answer then was something like, well, you know, you got to know me better. It's like, well, that was not really the point of it. But back to the Sky event, he gave an answer which we've actually heard him given a few times at his manifesto launch that I was at Silverstone, and that the Tories have been using in the media, which is that a vote for reform, obviously the Nigel Farage party, a threat on the Tories' right flank. A vote for reform is a vote to put Keir Starmer into number 10. They've also levied this charge about votes for Liberal Democrats. They're basically saying, vote for anybody else and you're going to give Labour a landslide. And it, you know, it's obviously their attempt to sort of scare their voters, not just to stay at home, or encourage their voters, I should say, not to stay at home, but to come out and vote for them. But it just sounded a bit desperate. It's like almost like an admission that they're going to lose by a landslide.
You know, one of the things that came through a lot in the audience reaction afterwards was that Rishi Sunak looked defeated. And I think what I initially interpreted as a willingness to listen and a certain amount of humility on the part of the Prime Minister, when put in the context of this campaign and when put in the context of the last few days, and especially, you know, Wednesday, when Grant Shapps has been out there saying, don't give Labour a supermajority, was that the rhetoric now just looks like they are giving up. And I think, you know, I don't know what Sunak does from here, but it's difficult because any attempt at contrition and humility then looks like defeatism. Any attempt at getting back on the front foot looks like Pollyanna-ish behaviour. It's really difficult to know what he can do to kind of pull out of that spiral.
And they just don't seem to be helping themselves. There was another interview aired tonight, which was Paul Brand from ITV, his interview with Rishi Sunak, that he recorded. It was the interview that he came back, the Prime Minister came back from Normandy to record. And there was a couple of clips released earlier in the day, one of which was the arrival of the Prime Minister in the room, where he basically talks about, he apologises for being late, and he talks about how incredible the commemorations in Normandy were, but then adds, it just overran.
Prime Minister.
Gosh, hello.
Good to see you.
Very nice to see you. Hey, sorry
I'm
to have
well,
kept
thank you.
You.
No, not at all. I know you've been in Normandy.
Yeah, it all just ran over. There was, it of course. Was incredible, but it just ran over everything.
I'm sure it was a...
So apologies for keeping you.
No, not at all. I'm sure it was a powerful trip. I mean, so personal like sort of, as well this year.
Really? Did you not realise at that moment that it just seemed so tone deaf? Even then, even though he'd come back at that point, he didn't realise, and there was already sort of, you know, rumblings about his early return, he didn't realise and sort of seemed to be blaming it on...
Yes. I don't know. We don't know exactly when in the day that was recorded. It may be that he had no sense that it had been controversial. Certainly it was only after he recorded the interview that it really kind of blew up as a political issue. But it's been very interesting. Number 10 have known since then that there was this piece of footage which was going to be very damaging. And they must have been sitting there thinking, well, are they going to use it? Are they not? The bit that I thought for me was more damaging, actually, was Rishi Sunak talking about, he was pressed by Paul Brand on whether he'd ever gone without anything as a child. And he tried to brush it off and laugh it off at first and then said, well, famously, for some reason he used the word famously, Sky TV. I went without Sky TV as a child.
Have you ever gone without something?
Yeah, I mean, my family emigrated here with very little. Mm-hmm. And that's how I was raised. I was raised with the values of hard work
What did you go without as a child?
We went out with lots of things, right? Because my parents wanted to put everything into our education, and that was a priority.
So what sort of things had to be sacrificed?
Lots of things, right?
Can you give me an example?
All
of
sorts of things. So like lots of people, there'll be all sorts of things that I would have wanted as a kid that I couldn't have, right? Mm-hmm. Famously, Sky TV. Okay.
So and then that was something that we almost, had. I think, as soon as he'd said it, started to laugh nervously because he realised that what he'd said sounded ridiculous.
It was just very middle class, wasn't it? I mean, he had food on his table and he had a warm bed to sleep in, but oh my goodness, he'd had to do without Sky when actually he would have been better off giving a response along the lines of, you know, I was very lucky. I had a comfortable childhood, but I know how lucky I was, and I know lots of other people haven't had that experience, and that's why I want to do all these things that I want to do.
Look, you know, there's an answer there. My parents worked incredibly hard to make sure we got everything we wanted. Mm. And, you know, they came to this country with relatively little, but they managed to get themselves into a position where they could send me to a good school, and I want that opportunity for other people. It's not that hard.
No, it's not. And now, when you all pick up your copies of The Guardian today, you'll see a couple of stories on the front page. And actually, Kieran and my names are both there. So before we go, I just thought we should quickly update you on what those stories are. And I had a big exclusive story about Rishi Sunak's closest parliamentary aide, a guy called Craig Williams, who's standing again to be an MP in Wales. I discovered that he had placed a £100 bet on the election being in July, just 3 days before the Prime Minister named the date. And as a result, the Gambling Commission, which is the sort of the regulator in this sector, has launched an inquiry because Ladbrokes, which was the bookmaker, has this sort of system that produces like an automatic red flag against the names of politicians and other people described as politically exposed persons, that any sort of bet like this might be potentially problematic. This is going to create questions for Craig Williams, who is Sunak's parliamentary private secretary, and of course the Prime Minister himself, about who knew the election date and when.
Pippa, I've known about this story for a few days. I've obviously been sitting next to you today as you were working on it and watched it be published. And still, as you're reading out the details, I'm sitting here with my head in my hands because I can't quite believe what I'm hearing. It's absolutely astonishing story. This is somebody, we don't know whether he actually knew the date of the election, but he obviously had reason. There obviously is reason that he might have done, as somebody who was very close to Rishi Sunak and would have been in
and it's potentially very highly embarrassing for the Prime Minister, whose campaign, let's face it, has been pretty calamitous so far. And here we have yet another Tory own goal.
I want to introduce our listeners to the genie theory, which I told you about today. This is the theory that at some point in his leadership, Keir Starmer rubbed a lamp and a genie appeared. And this genie, at some point during their conversation, has forgotten to tell Keir Starmer that he only has 3 wishes. And so Keir Starmer keeps making wishes and they keep coming true. So whether that is, you know, basic things like the rise of reform or, you know, the Liz Truss mini budget or Rishi Sunak deciding to go early to the electorate or then deciding to stay, not to stay at the D-Day celebrations. Everything seems to have gone right for him. And every time we think there's a little lull in the Tory mishaps during this election campaign, there is another absolute barnstormer. So the genie has come up trumps again.
So now it does sound obviously that Starmer and Labour have been lucky, but actually I think it's because you're at the end of a long cycle of British politics where the Conservatives have been in charge. And ultimately, when you get to this point, people in a party are tired, like really tired.
Yeah.
Some of them take being in power for granted and think that they don't need to try anymore because they've been in power for so long. Yeah. And I'm afraid there is also an element of power corrupting. Mm. And I think those sort of the confluence of those 3 things can end up in a position that we've seen with the Conservative Party in recent years, where we've had, frankly, far too many scandals. Now, The other story in our front page is, of course, going to be the Labour Party manifesto, which, having had the Lib Dems on Monday, the Tories on Tuesday, the Greens on Wednesday, Thursday comes round, and Keir Starmer is going to be unveiling his promise to the country for what Labour government would do. And this is going to be particularly interesting, given that we all generally expect Labour to win the election. This will actually be their mandate for governing. How much are we going to see in it, Kieran? What should we expect?
Well, there's nothing in there, from everything we're told, that we have not been told about before. No surprises in this manifesto, we've been told several times, and from what we're told overnight about it, that is definitely the case. So given that there's no new policy announcement, I think the interesting thing about this manifesto is how it's being presented. Now, it is structured, unsurprisingly, around Keir Starmer's five missions, but I'm told a third of it will actually deal with the economy. And the way that the economy is being presented in the economic argument, it's actually not so much about the cost of living, it's about growth. And it's particularly about wealth creation. And Keir Starmer will say that this is a manifesto that puts wealth creation at its centre. And the first item, the first manifesto promise that Labour have talked about in what they have told us overnight is a promise not to raise corporation tax. I was quite surprised at a cap on corporation tax at 25%. That's not the most obvious thing to lead.
It's also something that they've already announced. And actually, the Tories kind of did their work for them, because the Tories put it up from 19% to 25%.
Yeah.
So,
but it's framing, isn't it? It's the fact that they want to put a pro-business measure at the centre of their manifesto just tells you exactly who they're pitching for.
It's wealth creation, isn't it? And that we heard this a little bit from Starmer over the last few days. Not just about putting economy front and centre, but being sort of unashamedly proud of the fact that a Labour government under him would want to see people earning money. In some people's minds, that will seem a bit sort of out of kilter with some of the places that the Labour Party has been in recent years.
Look, the whole document, from everything I'm told, is a very clear pitch to right-leaning voters, people who voted Tory in 2019. And whether that's the way the economy and the economic argument is framed, or I'm told there is a lot in this manifesto about security and policing. There is even, I'm told, a photo of Starmer in combat. Everything is very focused on that one group of voters. Now, there are things that I think will be of interest to the left. I mean, there is mention of Palestinian statehood. There's quite a lot of material on workers' rights. But there are also things that the left wanted and they didn't get. They wanted, for example, some kind of limit on the way in which the private sector can be used to bring down NHS waiting lists. They haven't got that, I'm told.
Two-child benefit? Not
obviously, they've not got the two-child benefit cap. There was even a piece of wording that was in the National Policy Forum document, which came out last year, which said something like the NHS is not for sale. That wording has been dropped. That's not in the manifesto. So you can tell what the pitch is that the Labour Party is making. The thing is, it's not a very exciting pitch right now because we know so much about this already. And it's really the opposite of the Tory manifesto. And it's interesting, I think, that Rishi Sunak unveiled this very retail manifesto, stuffed full of promises, giveaways, tax cuts, all sorts of things just thrown at the wall. And rather than worrying about that and trying to copy it in any way, Labour believe that that is actually playing to their favour.
Well, they do. That's right. I was at that manifesto launch, and Tory aides afterwards were being asked questions like, isn't this like Jeremy Corbyn's 2019 manifesto? Yeah. You're packing it so full of stuff that no one will believe that you can deliver.
Yeah.
That's been one of Labour's consistent arguments. This Labour, we can't call them New Labour, can we? What do we call them? Changed Labour. Keir Starmer's Labour, that's been one of their consistent arguments, that one of the reasons they can't do a repeat of the 2019 manifesto and why they justify not being able to make big spending promises is because they say that people don't actually believe that they would be able to deliver them. And they recognise that people have kind of lost faith in politicians making promises. We had some of that in the debate tonight. And under all of this, there's that sort of been that slow diminution of trust in British politics, which is actually, just to sound really lofty for a moment, really damaging to our democracy. If Labour are conscious that over-promising and under-delivering will make that worse, and as a response to it, have decided to under-promise and then maybe over-deliver, I mean, maybe I'm being a hopeless optimist here, then maybe that's not such a bad thing.
yes, the reverse argument is this, that if Labour gets into power and does a load of things that they didn't put in their manifesto, people could get very angry about that. And there is, I think, a split even within the Labour Party about what the manifesto should be between those people who think it should be a document that secures the win and those people that think it should be a mandate for power. And there are a lot of people who worry that if we don't get a mandate for what we want to do, it's going to be much tougher to do it. And if we do try and do it, we're going to really anger people very early on. So that's the kind of argument that I think has been had. And you can tell which way Keir Starmer's gone.
So that's all from us. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This is The Guardian.